originated as Steve's idea. He said we should have something on basic bourgeois economics, and he wanted me to talk on a book brought out by the Bank of England. Anyway, I chose the title, which I'm afraid I can't stick to, because the title is How to Read the Business Pages. It has to be changed to How to Read the Front Pages, because I mean, it was obvious that the present, or the late government, was going to fail, but eventually, but not so quickly and so spectacularly. I mean, I'll read a typical passage from a business page. The prospect of a slowing economy, tax cuts, higher borrowing, and a record current account deficit have battered the pound this year, forcing it to the lowest since 1985 against the dollar. So this is the sort of thing that you normally read on the business page of a newspaper, but it's moved in the last few weeks onto the front page. So what I want to do is basically explain some of the terms which have been used recently, I'll say, not just on the business pages, but on the front page. And the big one, of course, is growth. I mean, the late Liz Truss promised that she had a bold plan to have growth of 2.5% a year. Now, when politicians and journalists speak of growth, they can mean either of two things. One, they can mean the growth of productive capacity, or two, they can mean the growth of what is actually produced. I mean, normally they mean, the second, how much is produced. Now, growth in this sense is generally measured as an increase in GDP, which is short for gross domestic product. Now, what is this? I mean, here's the clearest definition that I found on the internet. GDP measures the monetary value of final goods and services, that is, those that are bought by the final user, produced in a country in a given period of time, say a quarter or a year. Now, this GDP can be calculated in a number of ways. I mean, the main one is to work out for each industry the difference between what they paid for their materials and intermediate goods and what they sold their product for, and then to add all these up. And this is what the statisticians call value added, and in fact, it's what VAT is levied on. Now, it's not the same as cost of production. What it is wage costs plus the profit margin. Now, conventional economists are less keen to use this term, value, as they banish the whole concept of value from economics, even though if in this case value simply means market price. On the other hand, this concept of value added corresponds more to what Marx in economics would understand by the term, that is the new value created in production, which is divided between wages and profits. Now, add in the income from work or from property ownership that individuals receive is in fact the second way of calculating GDP, which is in fact the same as sometimes called the national income. It gives a share of labor in what is produced, but it also includes income from self-employment as well as income from wages. Now, the third way is by adding up how the national income is spent, whether it's spent on business investment, consumer spending, or on government spending. In practice, the national accounts statisticians use all three calculations to check and to get an accurate figure as they can. If GDP is higher than it was the year before, then there's been growth. But of course, GDP doesn't always go up. It can also go down. In fact, the statisticians and economists define a recession as a fall in GDP in two consecutive quarters. And most of GDP, about 80%, is consumed in the course of the year, or quarters, the case may be, either by individual consumers or by the government. The rest is invested mostly by business, with some by the government, as in infrastructure projects. The statisticians call this gross fixed capital investment, its increase represents an increase in productive capacity. But in fact, we don't want the gross figure, we want the net figure, that is, the total amount less the part that's used to replace the wear and tear of fixed capital. This is the nearest you can get in official statistics to what Marx understood by capital accumulation. And this is not normally, this idea of net fixed capital formation is not normally mentioned on the business pages, but there are references to business investment, which in fact is the key factor bringing about growth. And Marx saw capital accumulation as the aim of capitalist production, and the source of this accumulation is the profits that come from business investments, including what the government spends on infrastructure, since this ultimately comes from taxing business profits. It is this pursuit of profits to accumulate as new capital that drives the capitalist economy and results in growth. So in fact, strictly speaking, growth as such, as a growth in GDP, is not the driving force of capitalist production. What is the growth of productive capacity, which permits an increase in production. Of course, this doesn't always happen. Just because you can produce more doesn't mean the capitalist society does produce more. I mean, this depends on profitable outlets. Well, governments can do nothing about this. They just have to wait for the outlets to emerge and business investment to increase as capitalist production moves through its boom-slump business cycle. I mean, sometimes they're lucky, as Blair was, and can claim that the boom phase of the cycle results of their policies. But of course, when it doesn't go right, they don't take the blame for this. I mean, the late Truss government was planning that growth should increase, as I said, by that's the figure they use, 2.5% a year. And they were hoping that this would result if they allowed businesses to retain a greater share of the profits they made. But all this has, of course, since been abandoned. But Starmer probably has a similar figure in mind and is proposing to take a less laissez-faire approach. But of course, he also accepts that growth can only come out of profits to sustain if profits to sustain it are allowed to be made. I mean, he talks about a strategy which builds confidence for investors that will boost long-term growth and productivity. But it's the same thing. He means they should be allowed to make profits and so have the conditions for this. And moving on to the next set of words that have been used on the business pages and say more recently on the front pages, the government's finances. And here the key terms are the budget and the national debt. I mean, the budget is what you would expect it to be. It's what the government anticipates spending in the coming year. Sorry? Anyway, as I was saying, I mean, the budget is what you'd expect it to be. It's what the government anticipates spending in the coming year and how it expects to finance it. I mean, it's divided like that of a business firm into current income, which is on salaries, pensions, health, education, and so on, and expenditure on a capital project, such as HS2 and things like that. Now, governments as such don't have any income of their own. If they are themselves engaged in productive activity, they will have some, of course, but this will be as a capitalist enterprise rather than as the government. In fact, most state-owned industries or businesses are public corporations whose accounts are separate from those of the government itself. So, in fact, in Britain, any income the government gets from its own activities can be ignored. Now, a balanced budget is one where current government spending is matched by money raised through taxation. And this is considered by politicians who think like Mr. McCorver to be what government should always do. But doing this could result in taxation being too high or government spending being too low for a capitalist state. The alternative is to run a budget deficit in the sense of spending more than raised by taxation and borrowing the difference. And this is how the Napoleonic Wars were financed, and World War since, and in fact, since the time of the Napoleonic Wars, the national debt has been more or less permanent. And this, of course, is a misnomer, since it's not the debt of the people of a country, but that of its government. A more accurate word and name or description would be the government debt. In fact, it is sometimes referred to as sovereign debt, which is more accurate, I think, than national debt. Now, the government borrows long term, I know, for 2, 5, 10, 20, or even 30 years. And they do this by selling bonds which pay a rate of interest tied to their face value. For example, £100 at 5%. However, while the amount of interest payable remains the same, for example, at least in this case, £5, the price at which the bonds are bought and sold on the bond market can vary. So if the price falls to, say, £90, the interest is still £5. The £5 over £90 is 5.56%. And this is described in the everywhere now as the yield. If the price rises, on the other hand, to £110, the yield is 4.5%. So what this means is that when the government sells new bonds, it has to take into account the yield on existing bonds and offer them at that rate of interest. I mean, the government also borrows short term by selling treasury bills, which are repayable after 3 months. And this covers any variation in their short term needs. Financial institutions hold them as, in effect, interest bearing cash. These are traded on the money market. Now, those who lend money to the government get paid their interest out of taxation. I mean, this is not a problem for a well-established capitalist state, which can get a regular flow of income from taxation to pay this, as well as to repay the loans. So here I should say that most or many of the loans are renewed as to what the investor is interested in is the interest. Here again, there are some capitalist politicians who fret about this from a capitalist point of view, as a larger national debt means higher taxation. But lending to the government in a well-established state like Britain is a very safe investment. And such a government is never going to default or go bankrupt, because it's always in a position to raise money by taxation from which the taxpayers can't refuse to pay. Now, there's a third way in which a government could finance its spending. It can have recourse to the printing press. I mean, not necessarily literally, but by creating more money tokens and then spending them or getting them into circulation one way or another. I mean, some governments have done this, but it always comes back to bite them in the end. If the extra amount issued is more than what the economy requires for its transactions, the result will be a general rise in the price level. And this will not increase the amount of wealth in existence. It's not going to lead to an increase in GDP. With more money tokens needed chasing an unchanged amount of wealth, they will depreciate and their purchasing power will fall as more of them come to be needed to buy anything. And the price of everything will go up. And rather than production increasing, the result will be a redistribution of who gets what. Basically, it will benefit borrowers, including the government, so they can pay back in depreciated money, whatever it is they borrowed. It'll be the equivalent of a tax on lenders, since their real income will be reduced. But it won't last for long, of course, because lenders, including those who lend to the government, will soon cotton on and will be reluctant to lend more unless they can get a higher rate of interest. So the interest on the national debt will rise. Now, the next set of terms is what concerns the bank rate and inflation. I mean, the bank rate, or what's officially called the base rate, is the rate of interest at which the Bank of England lends money to the banking system. I mean, it's fixed each month by a monetary policy commission committee, and it's independent of the government. In fact, there was a reform introduced by Gordon Brown in 1997. The bank rate influences the rate at which banks charge those who borrow money from them, for instance, you know, to buy a house, and to pay those who have deposited money with them, you know, savers. It influences the rate at which financial institutions pay to borrow from each other on the money market, and this in turn influences what banks charge or pay their customers. And there's no legal obligation on banks to follow the bank rate, but it's only market pressure. I mean, banks are in competition with each other, and if they don't do this, they'll lose out in the battle of competition. Now, although governments don't interfere with the operation of the Bank of England, it does set its targets. At the moment, the bank's remit or mandate is to keep the general price level rising at about around 2% a year. I mean, the price level is measured by the Consumer Price Index, as calculated monthly by the Office of National Statistics, which carries out a survey of how the basket of goods bought by the average household varies from month to month. And this is the index, which currently is, well, has been announced, has been rising at 10% a year. Now, the business pages and the media refer to a rise in the cost of living index as being inflation. I mean, we like to stick to the original and literal meaning of the word as an overissue, an inflation of the money supply created by the government. But what this means is that more of the currency units come to be required to buy a product, and so its price, which of course is expressed in the monetary unit, goes up. And inflation, in this sense, affects the price of everything, at least say to a rise in the general price level. Now, we're probably fighting a losing battle over the word inflation. We'll have to settle for an overissue of government-created money being recognised as a separate, distinct way that causes the cost of living index to rise. In fact, this is the only way in which the Bank of England can have any effect on the index. I mean, it can't control other factors that can cause prices to rise, such as a rise in the price of some imported goods due to supply problems or to some international cartel. I mean, the governor of the Bank of England is always moaning that he can't do anything about this, as it's beyond his control, and of course he's right. So what the Bank of England's remit to keep the cost of living rising at about 2% a year means in practice is they should not let the rate of increase fall below that figure, which you can only do by inflating the currency in the original sense of the word. I mean, what the government wants is for prices to rise each year by this amount of 2%. I mean, if achieved, it means that in 5 years' time, the general price level, including wages, will go up by a little over 10%, in 10 years by about 22%, and in 20 years by nearly 50%. I mentioned why. I guess nobody here can remember what wages they were paid 10 years ago, let alone 20. Now, the final section I want to deal with is the exchange rate and the balance of payments. I mean, the crisis following the Truss government's tax-cutting quasi-budget has brought international payments into prominence. I mean, two different things happened. I mean, the pound devalued, and international speculators sold government bonds, bringing down their price, and so sending up the yield, which is the effective rate of interest, meaning that the government has had to pay more to borrow. Now, the fall in the exchange rate of the pound as against the dollar, which means requiring more pounds to buy the same amount of dollars, is not called a devaluation these days, but that's what it is and would have been called officially up until 1971, when the US government ended its commitment to buy gold at the fixed price of $35 an ounce. Now, under that system, the currencies of IMF member states were tied to a fixed rate with the dollar, which was tied to a fixed amount of gold. That's hence the name of the system, as the gold exchange standard, as opposed to the gold standard, where gold itself was the means of settling international payments with currencies tied to it. If under this system, if for some reason a state's internal price level got out of line with the world level, the IMF could be asked to agree to the exchange rate of the currency, with the dollar being, well, devalued, which was the case in Britain, or revalued, which was the case of West Germany. And since 1971, currencies have floated up or down, not just against the dollar, but against all other currencies. For instance, in the current crisis, the pound fell not just against the dollar, but also slightly against the euro, as the exchange rate of the euro against the dollar was also falling, but not as fast. I mean, what this suggests is what was actually happening was that the dollar was being upvalued or revalued. Now, with floating currencies, what determines a currency's day-to-day exchange rate is how much is bought and how much is sold. I mean, leaving aside speculators, a currency will typically be bought to pay for exports, whether goods or services, or to transfer profits made abroad, or to invest in the country. It will be typically sold to obtain another currency to pay for imports, to transfer profits to another country, or to invest there. I mean, and speculators, meanwhile, will be betting on how the exchange rate might move in the near or longer term. I mean, under normal circumstances, a country's exchange rate would reflect the country's economic situation in relation to the world market, taking into account its costs of production and its internal price level, generally referred to as its competitiveness or competitivity. Well, the balance of trade is a comparison of exports and imports. I mean, there's no reason why it should balance. I mean, for years, Britain had an unfavorable balance of trade, with much more imports in value than exports. But this was offset by profits sent back from overseas investments. I mean, the problem can arise if, after these are taken into account, there is still a deficit. What the business pages call confusingly, as in the quote I gave at the beginning, the current account deficit. If you just read the word current account deficit, it could mean anything, but in fact, it's always used in reference to the balance of trade and balance of payments. Now, if there is a current account deficit, the deficit has to be covered as payments in and out have to be balanced. One way is to attract foreign investment. Another is to raise via the bank rate, the short-term rate of interest, to attract international speculators. And if this fails, then the government has to dip into its foreign currency reserves, or even or gold reserves even, if the situation threatens to use up much of the reserves, or too much of the reserves, then there's a balance of payments crisis, which a government can ask for financial help from the IMF, which of course comes at a price, generally with harsh conditions to control government spending. So that's the end of my talk, which is deliberately meant to be descriptive rather than putting a particular socialist angle on it, but it's hopefully help people to understand what's, you know, and so on the business pages, or what's been on the front pages. Okay, thanks.